What kind of a show are you guys putting on here today?
You're not interested in art?
No.
Well, look, we're going to do this thing. We're going to have a conversation.
From Chicago, this is Film Spotting. I'm Adam Kempinar.
And I'm Josh Larson. Do you know what a duvet is?
It's a comfort.
It's a blanket. Just a blanket. Now, why do guys like you and I know what a duvet is? Is this essential to our survival in the hunter-gatherer sense of the word? No.
Everybody knows the first rule of Fight Club is you do not talk about Fight Club. But we can join Tyler Durden in exploring our primal selves with a countdown of our top five survival movies.
Plus, we'll see if we can emerge unscathed from a discussion of The Impossible, starring Best Actress Oscar nominee Naomi Watts. Grab a blanket. All that and more is ahead on Film Spotting.
Film Spotting is brought to you by Audible.com, the internet's leading provider of audiobooks with more than 100,000 downloadable titles across all types of literature, including fiction, nonfiction, and periodicals. For a free audiobook of your choice, go to audiblepodcast.com/filmspotting.
And by Squarespace. Now, Squarespace.com is faster and easier than ever to create a high-quality website, blog, or online portfolio. Squarespace is a unified service for giving you everything you need to create and maintain a professional-looking website, from domains, design, development, hosting, and support. We have a lot of Film Spotting listeners out there who use and recommend Squarespace. Some of the features specifically that our listeners enjoy are the professionally designed templates to make your website look exceptional. You've got hundreds of customization options to change the layout and colors and fonts on the fly. It's a 100% drag and drop interface, so you don't have to be a hardcore coder to make your website look great. It's also optimized for mobile devices, so anything you update for your site will automatically be restructured to look great on any smartphone, tablet, or computer. They also offer excellent social media integration, so if you want to pull photos from Instagram into your site or sync pages and galleries to Facebook or auto-publish new blog entries on Twitter, you can easily do that. And they even offer great online resources and a support team to give you email support 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, including live online workshops for all levels of experience.
For a free all-inclusive trial, go to squarespace.com. You can sign up for a free account there. You don't need a credit card. Just try it out, and you can start building your website. If you do decide to purchase it, use offer code FILM2, and you'll get 10% off your first purchase on new accounts. That means 10% off your first month or 10% off 1 year, which is an even better deal. That's squarespace.com/film and use offer code FILM2. Squarespace, everything you need to create an exceptional website.
You're listening to Film Spotting with Adam and Josh. I'm just going to use this stick here and try to light a little fire in the studio just in case we need it for our top five survival movies later in the show. We're also going to get to the first film in our Marx Brothers marathon, Animal Crackers.
But first, with The Impossible, El Orfanato director Juan Antonio Bayona does for Thai resorts what he previously did for Spanish orphanages. Let the trauma commence.
Oh God!
The most scary bit for me.
And the water hit?
When I came up. That was all on my own. And then I saw the two of you. I didn't feel so scared anymore. If Mummy and Lucas are on their own right now, I'm gonna keep looking for them.
One love.
I'm scared.
One life.
I'm scared too.
When it's one need in the night.
During a bonus content discussion in December, Adam, we talked about the term Spielbergian a bit. Listener Roman from Northern California had left a voicemail, and he noted that it was most often used in a negative way to represent Spielberg's worst traits. I'm going to try to correct that a little bit here and suggest that with The Impossible, director Juan Antonio Bayona is Spielbergian in the best way possible. This is the story. It's based on an actual account of a family vacationing in Thailand when the 2004 tsunami struck. Naomi Watts and Ewan McGregor play the parents of three boys who are separated in the aftermath, and the movie charts their anguished attempts to be reunited. The notion of family, obviously that's a Spielberg element, but what most brought the director to my mind as I was watching The Impossible is the way that Bayona masterfully stages so many of the suspense sequences here, most notably the scene of the tsunami hitting the resort as the family is in the pool. The way he foreshadows terror, there's that moment with the blender losing power, and he slowly starts the suspense boiling with the use of a red ball that the boys are playing with. These are carefully calibrated moments mm-hmm. that reminded me of bits from Raiders of the Lost Ark or even Jaws. Now, I know that's awfully high praise to your mind, Adam, considering how much you love those two films. Would you put the evoking of tension in The Impossible on that level, or did the movie strike you as just another well-made disaster flick?
Well, just for the sake of expressing my reaction, I'm going to stick with the typically pejorative use of the term Spielbergian here, and maybe I can best sum up my reaction this way. It's so Spielbergian, Josh, that if Spielberg himself watched it with the director, at the end, I envision him turning to Juan Antonio Bayona like Joseph Welch to Joseph McCarthy and saying, "Have you no sense of decency, sir? At long last, have you no sense of decency?" Spielberg, at his most shameful, was never as bad as what we see here in The Impossible.
No.
I'm sorry, and I won't get into specifics of it because it's a big climactic sequence, but there's a sequence in this film that infuriated me as much as any movie sequence I can ever recall sitting through. It's so calculated and so contrived in its effort to draw out suspense and produce a wallop of an emotional payoff that I frankly found it contemptible.
It walloped me.
Yeah.
If it's the same scene we're talking about, you're going to have to tell us what scene it is.
You can't help but be walloped. It is the climactic sequence. That's all I need to say about it. You know which one I'm talking about. It's the moment the whole movie has been building up to. But for me, these lives and the lives of all those affected by this real-life tragedy deserve better than to have their experiences.
Don't take this approach.
They deserve better. I'm saying the characters in the film. The real-life tragedy is just another part of it. I'm saying these characters in the film deserve better than to be denigrated by being pawns in this cinematic chess game. And when we talk about true life stories, I'm happy to give filmmakers a lot of latitude in telling the story they want to tell, regardless of the subject matter, regardless of whether it is factual or not. There's inevitably, Josh, going to be some storytelling shortcuts. There's going to be manipulation on the part of the filmmaker to provoke a response. I'm fine with all that. But I do think here Bayona goes too far. I think that this film, for me, was just like watching some of those Alejandro Gonzalez and Iñárritu films I have so much trouble with, like Babel, where we're essentially forced to sit for 2 hours or so and watch people suffer and suffer some more and suffer some more. Also, we and some of the luckier characters in the film can learn something valuable about what's really important in life. I think it's phony humanism, and for me, it's actually distasteful.
I didn't think that I learned anything valuable, but I thought I was put through this extremely intense experience that may have been very much like what people experienced. I wasn't looking for deeper meaning here. I was looking for a visceral, horrible, traumatic experience translated to me in a way that I could feel what they might have gone through. I think it was very genuine and authentic in that way.
Hmm.
Are you talking about coincidence that you had a problem
That's
with?
That's part of it. That's part of the manipulation, but only a part of it.
Well, what way could, if the point of this story is to trace the unlikely reuniting of a family, let's just leave it as generic of that, in what way would it have been more honest for you to have depicted that?
Isn't this part of the show where I get to say I don't have to rewrite or remake his movie? I just
understand,
get to be critical of it.
I understand that. I understand that response. But I did not feel this to be shameless at all. I thought it earned every moment. And the main reason for that is because it was so rooted in the specifics of this family. I wasn't worried about the mechanics going on because I was worried about these personalities, how the mother, I think we can say that the mother played by Naomi Watts and the oldest son are separated from the others in the family at the beginning, right after the tsunami, and the majority of the first half is devoted to them.
Mm-hmm.
And what I appreciated is how everything they encountered was not just floods
mm-hmm.
or pain or wounds, but how Bayona and the screenwriter Sergio Sanchez rooted it in their relationship. It wasn't just that they were suffering from wounds. There's the great scene where the son notices that his mom has this gaping wound
mm-hmm.
and it's across her breast, actually, and her shirt has been ripped open. And he's embarrassed by this, but has to feel that he has to point it out. And he kind of does it and then looks away.
Mm-hmm.
And that's just one example of how this trauma is rooted in this family and the relationships. We get a whole picture of how those two relate to each other and how that's going to change through this event. So this was not just pawns is the absolutely wrong word to use for the level of characterization that is going on in this film.
Wait, did you hear that? There's nothing we can do. Wait.
We are almost there. We have to get to safety.
We have to help that boy.
If another wave catches us down here, we will die. We have to climb that tree right now. Come on.
Where are you?
Mum, look at you! We need help! We can't risk it, Mum. Come on.
Listen. What if that boy was Simon or Thomas? What if they needed help? You'd want someone to help them, wouldn't you?
Simon and Thomas are dead!
You're listening to Film Spotting with Adam and Joshua arguing about the film The Impossible, which garnered an Oscar nomination for Best Actress for one of its stars, Naomi Watts. And I think, Josh, I can pinpoint for you where the film started to really lose me, and I don't think we're spoiling anything here to say that Ewan McGregor is a character in this film, not just for the first 30 minutes or so. He does factor into the entire story. And it's about the time he shows up, and I won't get into too many more details with that because I don't want to give away more, but it's about the time he reappears that things start to go off the rails for me. And so I'm saying that all to acknowledge that there are some things about this film that definitely work for me, and you touched on them. These sequences with Tom Holland as the oldest son, Lucas, and Naomi Watts, they're both fantastic in this film, as you would expect from Naomi Watts, and Tom Holland, I believe, is a newcomer. They're wonderful together, and that scene that you mentioned specifically where it's this moment where he doesn't want to see his mom not only suffering, but really losing her dignity, and that's a theme, I think, that runs throughout the entire film. Those are great little moments like that. I think that's very effective. As I said, their performances are. I do think that largely the tsunami sequence and how it's handled is, in fact, masterful. So I do give Bayona a lot of credit there. But what you said in terms of not really being aware of the mechanics, I was aware of the mechanics of this film and feeling like I was being churned up in this machine the entire time I watched this film. And I think it gets back a little bit to a discussion we've had over the course of a couple different reviews on the show over the past 6 months or so about subtlety and whether or not we value it or it should be something we expect from art or want in great art. And as I said, I don't think it's always necessary, but I can tell you one case where I do think it's something I want from a director, and that's stories like this that right away tap into your greatest fears as an audience member sitting there, as a parent, as a father. Right away, you don't have to do a whole lot to heighten the stakes of this film. Right away, you are feeling like an emotional train wreck and imagining what you would be doing in a situation like this. The material is inherently that potent. It's so potent that the drama and the emotions don't need to be heightened, as I said, in any artificial way. I think the director in cases like this is best served by largely getting out of the way and letting the story work on the viewer. I don't think Bayona can get out of the way here. The camera is always stuck on these little details that you know, because of the way he heavy-handedly focuses on them, is going to factor into the story later. Or we get that extended conversation with Geraldine Chaplin, who I like seeing on screen, just as I like seeing her in a little bit in The Orphanage as well, because I don't think she makes a whole lot of movies anymore, and she is fun to watch on screen. But this conversation about the stars and how the light from dead stars still burns long after they're gone, it's so ham-fisted. And like I said, I think this is just emblematic of what's wrong with the larger film. It's so heavy-handed and telegraphed that I was constantly aware of the filmmakers working on me.
That is the weakest scene in the movie, and it's entirely unrepresentative of what else is going on in this film. Name me another scene that works like that, where it's that obvious in terms of dialogue. This film doesn't have a lot of dialogue. That's probably the lengthiest dialogue scene in the picture, and I'll admit it's a very weak one. Nothing else works like that. It sticks out like a sore thumb to
I'd
me.
I'd say every camera shot that lingers on, as I said,
what are these details that are being lingered on?
I could list 20 of them, including actually putting the camera at one point inside a refrigerator so we see him reach for a Coke can, and we know the Coke can's going to factor into the story in some way later. It's not a big point. I'm just saying, there are tons of these little signposts along the way.
The Coke can is great. The Coke can is great because it's a perfect example of how far removed from civilization they've suddenly become. The boy gets into the resort, and the first thing he wants to grab is a Coke can out of the hotel fridge, and the parents say, no, water is fine. And you see his face. It's also a relationship thing. You see he's becoming this petulant teen who doesn't really want to listen to his parents.
Right.
And then after the tsunami, he and Watts are trudging through waist-deep water, and he sees a Coke can floating there, and he grabs it and instinctively puts it in his shorts. That's
I'm
a great
that
touch.
For you.
That's a great touch.
Okay.
All of a sudden, we realize how far removed he is from that sort of convenience. How is that manipulative and shameless?
I didn't need him to do that. It's not shameless so much as what I'm saying is what I think is very heavy-handed about the film and making me aware
it's a little
of
detail.
The mechanics.
It's a little touch.
But it's not a little detail because the camera is so clumsy, I think, in the way it focuses on it to say, hey, This is going to come back. This is going to come back into play.
Didn't
I think
you
that's
feel
where I needed
how
subtlety.
Good that Coke tasted when they finally cracked it open after spending a day in the hot sun trudging around, and you realize this, at this particular moment, is everything to
His
them.
His mom just should have let him have
share
it in the first place. And if she wasn't
they
so mean.
They share it with each other, and the crucial question, oh, Adam, this Coke can is so
wow.
important.
You fell
because
for this
they
movie,
found,
hook, line, and sinker.
I really did. Because they find this boy who's missing, and they have a crucial conversation. Are they going to help this boy or move on their own? That is huge in terms of his moral development as a son and how
uh-huh.
she leads him to that point. The boy is up in the tree with them and the Coke can, and there's another moment. Are they going to share it with the kid, too? How survivalist are we going to get here? Oh, the Coke can. I love the Coke
if
can.
If only that moral development, if only that lesson had actually factored in and they had really taken that lesson at the end of the film. Wow. What kind of a better film might this have been if they actually
had
taken that
lesson? On the very final
lesson.
Conversation the son has with the mother,
uh-huh.
that's what they're talking about, is that he realizes
uh-huh.
she was right.
I wish so badly I could explain why. That conversation is undercut by what's going on in the scene.
I wish you
but
could,
I
too.
I can't because I don't want to ruin the final moments of the film. Even though they're not a surprise, I want people to experience them for themselves. Maybe in bonus content, I'll explain what I was getting at there and be more specific. But when we were discussing whether or not we would even review this film, we talked a little bit about how the big knock I heard just from various folks on Twitter, I still haven't read a review of this film, but I just heard, maybe I follow a lot of cynical people because I saw some of these more cynical, hardened film critics really taking apart this film for being one of these classic white people problems movies. You've got 300,000 people affected by this tragedy, most of them natives. And the only real perspective the movie chooses to give us is that of this rich white couple on vacation. So there's some validity to that. But at the same time, I think it's very unfair. It's an unfair indictment because I don't think there's any rule that says you can't tell a sweeping story from a limited, specific perspective. Somebody else can make a documentary about the tsunami and all the damage it caused and is still causing. Somebody else can make a narrative film if they want with Thai people at the center of the story or anybody else from any other country. That's fine. Is this story from a tourist perspective worth telling? Yes, I would say. Absolutely. It's an amazing tale, and I'm glad they chose to put it on screen. I was all set with this in mind to give the movie a complete pass on these grounds, but then an interesting thing happened. I watched the movie, and I saw these shots of Naomi Watts staring up at the nice Thai people as they dragged her to safety with the terribly cloying, poignant music that unfortunately happens throughout the entire movie, but especially here where it's overriding any dialogue, and she's looking up at these people in this dreamy state as they're nameless and they're voiceless. And Josh, it may not be about fear, in fact, just the opposite, but the way I would argue it fetishizes the others here is no different than what you complained about with Affleck in the Iranians.
Not even close.
Argo. And unfortunately, I can't get specific, again, because the worst stuff for me is, as
it's
I said,
it's unfortunate you can't get
end.
Specific for a lot of your points
I
on
can't.
This film.
Actually, I'm not going to give away the last 20 minutes of the film, Josh. I really wish I could. But I do think that Bayona, in these instances, tries to have it both ways. He emphasizes the distance. I'll speak about them generally here because I can't talk specifically. He emphasizes the distance and the discrepancy between the experience the natives have and the experience the tourists have. But at the same time, he only seems to care about and is only actually focused on the visitors. He only shows us their catharsis, their epiphanies, their moments of triumph and pain. And as much as I wanted to defend Bayona coming into the film, I couldn't after seeing it.
Not an issue for me at all. I like to think I'm sensitive to these sorts of things. I know when civil rights dramas try to tell a civil rights story through the eyes of a white character, that's been done before and is completely reprehensible. This was not an issue for me at all, precisely for one of the reasons you said. This is so focused on this one family.
Mm-hmm.
It's telling their story, and so we're seeing it through their eyes. And if their only encounter with some of the natives was when she is wounded and being dragged by them and being rescued by them, and she happens to look up into their face, then I'm okay with that. I don't need to have a sequence inserted of this family suddenly getting to know the natives
mm-hmm.
and realizing who they are as people, because this is a narrowly focused tale on this family's experience. If someone, as you said, wants to tell a story about the people who lived in Thailand and what their experience was like, then they can tell that story. But this was not using the people of Thailand as any sort of supporting character in a manipulative way. We encounter them as his family encountered them. I was fine with that.
That's fine, but you did basically just reword my counter argument to you from our Argo discussion.
No, Argo
you
is
did.
Entirely different. What
it.
Fear is being created of the Thai
said,
people
I just
in this
said
film?
It's not about fear, but the same argument you're making, just with different specifics, applies here. You basically said that you didn't need to see them interact with the natives in a different way, just as I accepted that in the particular film that we see in Argo, in this story, we're going to see Iranians being angry and violent. And you said, no, I need to see them not be exploited.
There's
to not
basically...
have this fear of the other. Here it's not fear. I already said that. It's not fear. But there is still an exploitation and a fetishization.
There's no exploitation.
Of them
there's
here
no
fetishization.
There's one sequence of Thai people
that
who
counts.
Come upon them.
He spends a lot
of
time.
And there's no
on
fetishizing
it.
Going
it
on there. These are the people who find her and rescue her and drag her to the hospital. That's where their encounter ends,
right.
Except for the hospital workers.
Just like
we
our hostages in Argo go out into the square.
No,
and feel,
in Argo,
and feel
throughout the movie, there are continual images of Iranian people depicted this way. It's not just one sequence in Argo. It's an underlying approach to a nationality.
Okay.
That's not what's going on in The Impossible.
Well, so you say. I think it is, and I want to be clear. The whole point of me bringing this up is not actually to defend Argo further, but to point out where I think you're being contradictory. But I will say, on a note that isn't really judgmental one way or another, I found it interesting to see a director here in Bayona who... I loved The Orphanage, so I really wanted to see what he was going to do next. And now that we've seen two films from him, you almost have to wonder if we're going to see a little bit of a trend, because there are definitely some similarities where you've got not only the same screenwriter, Sergio Sanchez, we have to give him credit for his authorial voice as well, but both films are about family tragedies. They're about children who are separated from their parents trying to reunite. And that film, you know what? That film's not subtle either, I wouldn't say, but that's okay because I expected the broad strokes of a horror movie we get in that movie. I think it's okay with a horror film. But I would just say no matter how much you may want to argue or others may want to argue that that's essentially what The Impossible is a horror film. I think it's more than that. It's a huge tragedy. Whether true or not, it's a huge tragedy that we watch unfold in this film. And I feel like there should have been more care in making it something more than just fodder for audience members to gasp and cry a lot. And that's what I felt like we got here.
And to share an experience. That's what I got there. I shared what it might have been like to have endured something like this. I don't care if we categorize it as a horror film, but what I did find interesting, having also appreciated The Orphanage, is how many elements of horror Bayona did incorporate into this story effectively, I thought. Not only is Watts's condition portrayed with such gruesomeness that she resembles a zombie as
there's
the movie
goes on. There's a sequence straight out of 28 Weeks Later in a hospital.
Definitely.
Yeah.
And I thought that was effective. There's that other moment in the hospital where a patient turns over and begins vomiting.
That's what I'm referring to.
Oh, that's the one. Yeah. I mean, that's
straight
just,
out of a Romero film or something.
Oh, yeah. But it works because it just brings that sense of dread and loss of control when they think they may be at a point where they're retaining some control over their situation.
Mm-hmm.
This happens, and that's an element of horror, is making characters lose control. So I did find this to be less of a hopeful drama with flickers of horror. It was a horror film with flickers of hope, and maybe that's why I found it to be less shameless than you did and less manipulative, because I saw it working on this other level.
Well, we want to know what you think. If you get a chance to see The Impossible or you've seen it already, it did come out around Christmas time and ended up on about 900 screens. I know it is still out in limited release. So if you see it and agree or disagree with our takes, let us know. Email us, feedback@filmspotting.net. You can also leave us a voicemail, 206-203-2463, or find us on Twitter @filmspotting and facebook.com/filmspotting.
After a one-week hiatus, during which Adam and I went to a Stanislavski boot camp, Massacre Theater makes its return next. Plus, we'll kick off our Marx Brothers marathon with 1930s Animal Crackers. Stay with us.
folks, we'd like to take a minute to remind you of our wonderful sponsors this week, including Squarespace. Squarespace.com's content management system makes it fast and easy to create a high-quality website, blog, or online portfolio. They give you everything you need to create an exceptional website, and they recently launched a developer platform for complete code control. For a free trial and 10% off new accounts, just go to squarespace.com/film, and your offer code is film2.
We're also brought to you by Audible.com, the Internet's leading provider of spoken audio entertainment, providing digital versions of tens of thousands of audiobooks for download to your computer, iPhone, Android phone, BlackBerry, and iPod. Listen whenever and wherever you want, just like the podcast you're listening to right now. Audible has more than 100,000 titles to choose from in every genre.
And we've got some recommendations for you here, a couple listener thoughts, and one for me as well, though I haven't yet listened to it myself. It's one I'm very curious about. It's I Am Spartacus, Making a Film, Breaking the Blacklist. And as we get to our top five here in a moment, Josh, listeners will see the connection and why I was thinking about Kirk Douglas this week. It sounds like a fascinating story, and he certainly is an actor who has a lot of stories, who's racked up a lot of tales over the years. And I'm also intrigued by the fact that it's narrated by his son, Michael Douglas. Huh. So if that sounds like something you'd be interested in, that's available now at audiblepodcast.com/film. We also got this recommendation from longtime listener Tyler Lyon. It's Extra Lives, Why Video Games Matter by Tom Bissell. Excellent stories about the writer's experiences with different types of games read by the author. And Josh, this is one that's actually come up on the show before, because every time we put out a call for Audible recommendations, it comes up. Our listeners seem to be, or a good chunk of our listeners seem to be, really fascinated by this audiobook. So I thought it was worth mentioning again.
It's a really good book, actually.
Oh, you know it.
I'm not a gamer, but I'm fascinated by this ongoing discussion of our video games art.
Mm-hmm.
And this is one of the best books I've seen to tackle it.
Wow.
So yeah, it's well worth checking out. We also got a note from Manuk Marjarian. He wrote, I finally caught up with Stephen King's The Shining. Without having read any of his books, I had gotten the impression that he was just a D-class cheap airport book writer. The Shining made me realize how brilliant his writing is. Now looking forward to The Stand.
Yeah, and Campbell Scott narrates that audiobook of The Shining. So if you needed more impetus to check out The Shining, I think that narration probably would help. We got those recommendations from Tyler and Manuk via our Facebook page, facebook.com/filmspotting. We'd love to get more of your recommendations. We'll feature them here on future shows. And Josh, that goes for Squarespace as well. As I said, I know a lot of our listeners use Squarespace for their blog or website, and we'd love to feature your site or blog. If you write in feedback@filmspotting.net, include the link, tell us why you like Squarespace, and maybe we'll feature it on an upcoming show. You can also do that via our Facebook page along with your Audible recommendations.
For a free audiobook of your choice, go to audiblepodcast.com/film. That's audiblepodcast.com/film.
Took my gun.
Yeah.
Who are you?
Nicholas. I'm Dr. Nicholas Garrigan. I work at the medical compound in Magambo. I'm a doctor.
You are British.
I'm Scottish. Yeah. I'm Scottish.
Scottish?
Yeah.
Why didn't you say so? I thought we discussed against the Mau Mau. Great soldiers. Very brave. And good people. Completely. Let me tell you, if I could be anything instead of a Ugandan, I would be a Scot.
Welcome back to Film Spotting with Adam and Josh. That's Forest Whitaker as Idi Amin in The Last King of Scotland, a performance for which he won the Best Actor Oscar. But Josh, what has Forest Whitaker done for us lately? We'll consider that as we get to our poll question this week about actors we'd like to see make a comeback. Right now, though, it's time for Massacre Theater.
We perform a scene, you get a chance at winning a prize. For our last performance, we massacred this scene.
You want to know why I came back so fast? At the end of our lane, I couldn't remember where the old town road was. One little way in the woods, there was nothing familiar, not one damn tree. It scared me half to death. That's why I came running back here to you. See your pretty face. I could feel safe. I was still me.
I'm safe, you old fool. And you're definitely still young. Thinking I'm poor old Charlie.
That was a not very shaky Katharine Hepburn and Henry Fonda in 1981's On Golden Pond. The director, Mark Rydell. The screenplay was by Ernest Thompson.
And we got some funny comments here, as you may expect after our performances last week, especially yours as Katharine Hepburn. You really went all out for it, Josh.
I thought I did her justice.
I think you did as well, though. I'm questioning that now, having said that. I mean, really? Did you do Katharine Hepburn justice or shame her legacy forever?
No, I think the former.
Okay, stick with that. Laura Ellis has more comments on our performances and our tie-in. She says, Josh's Katharine Hepburn was a treasure to behold.
See?
Assuming you are considering the treasure is a box of Cracker Jacks.
Oh, wait for it. Oh, boy.
Wait for it. And what can I say about Adam? The less said, the better. The tie was the love story late in life with Amour, the Michael Haneke film we did discuss a couple shows ago. I am now closer to the age of Fonda and Hepburn than to Jane Fonda's age when she made the film, and I can appreciate the nuance of the acting better, Laura writes. Both films were nominated for Best Picture, Actress, Director, and Screenplay, though On Golden Pond was from a play and Amour was original. So we were just going with the tie-in being the late-in-life love angle there. And, of course, we do get a listener shedding even more light and more insight and informing us that there's another connection in terms of the Oscar nominations they got. Jack from Arlington, Virginia also wanted to chime in.
I haven't seen On Golden Pond in probably 20 years, but I remember that I found its depiction of dementia frightening and heartbreaking. Never more so, however, than when you two took a crack at it.
And the jokes continue. David Steffi from Prospect Heights. Adam, your talent is astounding. I swore that I was listening to a man living through the moderate to severe stages of dementia. And that was just the first hour of the podcast.
I have to say, while we were doing the scene, I was wondering, if we're still doing this in 40 years, is this what it's going to be? You're wandering from studio to studio.
Probably.
I'm trying to call you back by calling you an old poop and encouraging you to get back in the chair.
I got lost at the vending machine.
Yes. It could happen.
Josh. That's our future. If you want to hear those performances, and really, I don't know why you would want to, and our review of Amour, plus our top five most anticipated performances of 2013, you can find that show at filmspotting.net or via iTunes. I was surprised, Josh, as we got the emails flowing in from Asker Theater. We've lamented this for a while, that it seems any movie basically made before about 1985 doesn't seem to get a lot of entries.
Right.
And we understand that we do have probably a fairly large demographic that is roughly our age in their 20s or 30s, and maybe some of these films were missed. So it was a pleasant surprise when the entries for On Golden Pond started pouring in. One of the most entered Massacre Theaters we've had in a long time. Not a record breaker, but that we've had in a long time. So reach into the brimming film spotting hat and pick out this week's winner.
The winner is Dawn Palvarosa from Martinez, California.
Congratulations, Dawn. Email feedback@filmspotting.net and we'll set you up with your free 6-month subscription to Fandor.com. Josh, I did want to take a moment before we get to this week's Massacre Theater to recognize the fact, and we just missed this recently, that it's your 1-year anniversary since joining Film Spotting.
I was expecting a party. It didn't happen. And
maybe I can hook you up with a cake later. We'll see how the rest of the show goes. But I was talking with our producer, Sam Van Halgren, and we wanted to commemorate this. Your first show as permanent co-host was January 20th of last year. So again, we just passed the 1-year point. Wanted to honor that in some way. And it seems that, for better or worse, your biggest contribution to the show seems to be the gusto with which you go for Massacre Theater.
I don't know if I want to take pride in that being my biggest contribution, but proceed.
Well, so we thought the best way to express our gratitude and appreciation for your contributions over the past year was to play a montage.
Oh, no.
Of your greatest Massacre Theater hits. Here it is for your enjoyment and our listeners.
Here you enter the coils of the dragon. Here my power was born. Here all things are possible, and all things meet their opposing.
The future?
And the past.
I'm afraid I've never heard of you. What's your name again?
Joe Gillis.
No, sorry.
You ever hear of Lone Rider of Santa Fe?
I can't say that I have.
You mean I have to live out the rest of my life in this body? No effing way! You got me into this, you get me out!
Can't do that.
Why not?
Because you're an abomination. An outrage against nature. You perverted everything I taught you and you used it for evil. And you have to be stopped.
I see you look at this piece.
Yeah, I was wondering how much something like this went for.
$130,000.
Get the F out of here.
No, I cannot. It's serious because it's a high important piece.
Have you ever sold one of these?
Yes, I have, for a collector.
Get the F out of here.
No, serious. I said it myself.
And
scene.
Now, come on, that was fun. A little more Bronson Pinchot from Beverly Hills Cop, the Excalibur masterpiece you gave us.
Does it hopefully reveal that I can't be typecast?
I think it does.
Okay,
it shows
good.
You've got a lot of range.
Wide range of badness.
Well, we hope everyone enjoyed that as much as we did. I know Sam had a lot of fun putting it together. With that, let's get to this week's edition of Massacre Theater. I don't know how you're going to top those performances.
Yeah, I think we're just going to have to play this one pretty quietly after all that.
That was the greatest acting I have ever seen.
I just don't know how you do it, Gary. How do you make yourself so somber and emotional to make everybody cry like that?
It's not that hard, really. I just think about the saddest moment in my life.
Well, I don't think this week's scene is going to give you an opportunity for any funny voices or accents, but I never know with you. You might decide to bring one out anyway.
Just going to play it straight. Don't worry.
We're not going to give you any hints either with the tie-in to this week's show. In fact, maybe your only hint is, I don't know that there is a tie-in to this week's show.
I think we talked about this for a while, and then we finally ended up with something with no tie-in, but if you've been paying attention to things going on, you'll have
see, now you've already given it away.
Is that too much?
It's already too much. Let's just get to the scene. There is a reason why we're doing a scene from this film.
We have a reason why we're doing this. Okay,
as
I'm glad you cleared
tend
that up.
To here on Film Spotting. We don't just randomly pick these scenes. Massacre Theater is presented, as always, by Fandor.com, a site to discover, explore, and share independent, foreign, and classic cinema. More information at Fandor.com/filmspotting.
Help support the show by signing up now. Film Spotting listeners get the first 30 days free.
I'm going to start this scene off, Josh. I hope you're ready. You're going to give me the action.
And action.
I've known him for a lot of years. He's been nothing but trouble. Your mother used to say he's not such a bad guy. He just needs a chance, that he was sad. Well, I tried to be good to him, but I can't. Not anymore. I will not allow him or his daughter in this house. I will not allow you to spend time with her doing projects or whatever it is that you do. That's it. I hope we're clear on that.
We're not clear.
What'd you say?
We're not clear. You and I aren't clear about anything. We couldn't be less clear.
Son, please.
Just because Mom died doesn't mean you know anything about me. You don't. You don't know anything about her either. She's kind.
I'm not going to have this discussion.
She's nice to me.
I don't care what she is.
And scene.
And go to your room, Josh.
Yes, please.
If you know what film we just massacred, email the movie's title along with your name and location to feedback@filmspotting.net. Your deadline is Tuesday, February 5th.
The winner will be selected randomly from all the correct entries and announced on next week's show. To get official Massacre Theater rules, visit filmspotting.net.
Are you mixed up?
No, sir.
Are you more jumpy than you were before?
No, sir.
And how's your sleeping?
I sleep just fine, sir.
When you sleep, do you have nightmares?
Not as much as before.
You've had violent episodes.
Yes, sir, we all did.
You pulled a knife to the throat of an officer.
Will you box that out?
As if you haven't heard enough scenes from The Master and Joaquin Phoenix as we've been sharing all our end-of-the-year discussion over the past month or so. Nevertheless, there he is again. At least we picked a different scene than the processing scene.
That was nice of
you, Josh. We tried to help out listeners there a little bit, but it does tie in with our poll question from last week as the Oscar nominations had been announced around the time we posed this question to our listeners. And so we were curious which Oscar nomination listeners were happiest about, not most disappointed in, not something they wanted to be critical of, but what were they happiest about when the Academy Award nominations were announced? The options were Beasts of the Southern Wild getting a nomination for Best Picture, Django Unchained for Best Picture, Joaquin Phoenix, there from The Master, getting a Best Actor nod, Emmanuelle Riva with her Best Actress nomination for Amour, or Quvenzhané Wallace for Best Actress for Beasts of the Southern Wild, or finally, you had Other if you didn't like any of those five choices. Josh, how did it come out?
Well, I hope listeners feel good about picking on the little girl. Poor Quvenzhané Wallace, last place. Well, tied for last place, actually. 8%. Other also had 8%. And we'll talk about what some of those write-in options were. With 11% was Emmanuelle Riva. My choice, Beasts of the Southern Wild as Best Picture, received 20% of the vote. Django Unchained, thanks to your unrelenting praise of Tarantino over the years, Adam, I'm sure, received 25%. But winning, the guy we just heard, Joaquin Phoenix, with 27% of the vote.
And that was my vote, so I'm glad to see listeners corroborate me there. And we did, as you mentioned, have a lot of different candidates for that other option. I think 10 to 15 at least different answers were written in, including Jennifer Lawrence. Listeners were happy to see her get a Best Actress nomination for Silver Linings Playbook. And also Jessica Chastain. We got this comment from Adam Lancer.
I have only seen Django Unchained of the movies on this list, but I decided to go with Other, and I said Jessica Chastain's performance in Zero Dark Thirty. I thought she could have been nominated for three different movies last year, so I'm glad she is probably the favorite to win this year. It was the best performance of the year from the movies I have seen, and nothing about her performance seemed false. Stakes? This movie had more stakes than a circus tent. Loved the movie. Loved her performance. Did they use stakes for circus tents?
Nicely done, Adam. Amour was another film that got some write-in love, not just Riva getting some votes, but the film in general getting a Best Picture nomination. Michael Haneke, the director, getting a Best Director nod. We got this comment from Zach Mulhagen. He said, I voted for Emmanuelle Riva because she was absolutely heartbreaking in Amour, but I almost voted other with Amour for Best Picture. The fact that this film has broken out of the foreign language ghetto, where the Academy likes to place films so deserving that it doesn't know what else to do with them, made me extremely happy with this year's nominations. I would second that.
Yeah. That makes sense. I was surprised to see it break into that Best Picture category.
Yeah, it was a little bit of a surprise for me as well. Our most popular other entry, though, Josh, was Roger Deakins for Best Cinematography for Skyfall.
Kevin wrote in to say, for me, it's Deakins. His gorgeous cinematography elevated what was otherwise a fairly average Bond flick. Some shots from the conflagration at the country estate toward the end are still burned into my memory. I'm hoping that this year will, at long last, be Deakins' year, after a long, completely inexplicable history of being Oscarless.
Nice use of conflagration there, Kevin. Got to give it to you. And we did get one smart aleck commenter who said, are the Oscars still relevant to good filmmaking? As if... that's what we were suggesting by this poll question. Thank you. Yes, we know that the Oscars are kind of a joke, but you know what? It's another opportunity to praise some of our favorite
films. I would say they're more relevant this year than in many recent years. There's some great films being talked about because of the Oscars.
Well, let's get to this week's poll question. You can vote now at filmspotting.net. And we have a little bit of an Oscar tie-in, but we're really looking ahead to next week's show. We're planning on talking about the new film from director Roman Coppola, which is A Glimpse Inside the Mind of Charles Swan. It's currently available on VOD, and it's going to hit some theaters and select cities next weekend as well. And it got us thinking about how he hasn't made a film, at least to our knowledge, since CQ, which I think came out in the early 2000s.
And I think it's been only music videos in between.
I think you're right. And our plan next week is to share our top five director comebacks. So the movie that for us marked a good director, or at least someone who had made some pretty good films, returning to form. But that's not where we're going with this week's poll question. We're going to focus on actors and actresses, sometimes supporting actors and actresses, as we look at former Oscar winners specifically, who we'd like to see make a comeback. And that's simply your question. Which one of these would you most like to see make a comeback? Your options are
Adrien Brody, Gina Davis, Hilary Swank, Forrest Whitaker, or Renee Zellweger?
Josh, where are you going in this poll? I don't know. I'm going to have to think about it while you answer, so draw it out a little bit.
Well, I am having a tough time, so you'll get a few extra seconds here. I can't decide between Brody and Zellweger. I do have a soft spot for Zellweger, but seeing Brody in the Darjeeling Limited, the Wes Anderson film, I thought he fit in beautifully in that ensemble and saw a lot of potential for him possibly being in future Anderson films that hasn't come about yet. But I think I'd like to see that happen and have him really knock a performance out of the park in one of those pictures.
Well, I'm really tempted. And I think my first instinct was to go with Forrest Whitaker. He's an actor I've loved in so many films and often very small roles, but very memorable. You think about Fast Times at Ridgemont High. He appears briefly there. I love him in The Color of Money, that Martin Scorsese film as a pool hustler. And I did love him as Idi Amin in The Last King of Scotland, but I think I'm going to go actually with Gina Davis, just because I think she's one of those actresses. I think she's very talented, even though if you look at her filmography, there isn't a lot of what I'd call great films there, but she's very talented, and other than appearing in Stuart Little in 1999 or something, she's been completely off the radar. I think if the right project came along, Gina Davis could still show that she's got some acting chops.
Can I say that fairly or unfairly? That's probably the most unlikely one of this list. That it seems like that to me, but maybe it'll happen.
Okay, well, we want to know what you think. You can vote now at filmspotting.net. A couple quick housekeeping notes we wanted to get to. We will have some bonus content on this week's show for our Film Spotting app subscribers. If you have the Android app or the iPhone app, you can find more information about our mobile offerings at filmspotting.net and click on apps. But there is where you get a little bit of extra audio most every week, and on this week's edition, we're going to spend just a little bit of time on the Ang Lee film, The Life of Pi, because we have had a lot of listeners wondering why it hasn't come up at all, so we'll share that in bonus content. I may also share my quick reactions on Broken City and Gangster Squad as well.
You're going to talk about your sad January experiences in the movie theaters?
That's pretty much exactly where I'm going. We've got a good email, too, in response to our conversation last week about the bigger acting challenge, Daniel Day-Lewis versus Joaquin Phoenix, playing a real-life person on screen or playing a completely fictional character. We'll share that in our bonus content. We also have some passes to give away, 25 pairs of them, in fact, to the film Quartet. This is the directorial debut, hard to believe, of Dustin Hoffman, who doesn't appear in the film, but it's got an all-star cast, including Maggie Smith, Michael Gambon, some great British performers, also Tom Courtney, who for me was one of the biggest discoveries in my film spotting career during our Angry Young Man marathon, seeing him in The Loneliness of the Long Distance Runner and Billy Liar. Just a fantastic actor who, talk about in need of a comeback, he's a guy who has basically just been doing BBC stuff and radio stuff. He didn't like the roles that were being offered to him. Dustin Hoffman came along and convinced him to be in this film Quartet. So you can use these passes to see any time during its run here in Chicago. I believe it's playing at the Landmark Century Theater. So for our local listeners, if you want to enter for a chance to win that pair of free passes, all you got to do is email us feedback@filmspotting.net, put Quartet in the subject line, and include your name and address. We'll pick 25 winners randomly and mail those passes out to you. I can't say this about it, even though that film isn't one that's really drawn me to want to go see it. I did hear Dustin Hoffman's conversation with Elvis Mitchell on KCRW's The Treatment just this morning. In fact, I listened to it, and it's a fascinating conversation. It touches on a lot more than just that film, but Dustin Hoffman is a real raconteur, so that did make me automatically a little bit more curious about Quartet, and if you are too, all you got to do is email feedback@filmspotting.net with Quartet in the subject line.
The principal animals inhabiting the African jungle are moose, elks, and Nycticebas. Of course, you all know what a moose is. That's big game. The first day, I shot 2 bucks. That was the biggest game we had. As I say, you all know what a moose is. A moose runs around on the floor and eats cheese and is chased by the cats. The elks, on the other hand, live up in the hills. And in the spring, they come down for their annual convention. It is very interesting to watch them come to the water hole. And you should see them run when they find it is only a water hole. What they're looking for is an elk hole. One morning, I shot an elephant in my pajamas. How he got in my pajamas, I don't know.
One of the more well-known Groucho Marx lines there from the 1930 Marx Brothers film Animal Crackers. It was their second film following The Coconuts the previous year, and it's the first film we're watching as part of our Marx Brothers marathon, the first of 4 movies we'll get to by the legendary comedic ensemble. And speaking of legendary comedic ensembles, Josh, about a year ago, we did a top five list where we shared our top five comedy ensembles. And there was no Marx Brothers to be found.
No.
And we heard about it. We heard about it from our listeners, as we expected. Mike Schutt in Austin, Texas wrote in, "I may have disagreed with some of your choices, such as the Kevin Smith and Wes Anderson troupes. That's fine. I get I'm in the minority on those. However, there was one omission I was truly shocked by, the names Groucho, Harpo, and Chico. How the Marx Brothers, which would easily have been my number one, missed the cut is really hard to wrap my head around. The consistent wit, wordplay, and anarchy have been unmatched on the silver screen." We also heard from Josh Biesler. He said, "The show was the absolute apex of my righteous indignation. Top five comedy ensembles without Monty Python, and even worse, the impossibly egregious exclusion of the Marx Brothers. Words cannot express my dissatisfaction. The Marx Brothers are the standard by which film comedy is measured. Fact."
I had forgotten about how disappointing we were.
I think he ended that with, "Good day, sir." That's how strongly he felt about it. Now, during that show, I did cop to the fact that our lists were going to be without a really obvious choice. I felt the shame going into that top five. And in your defense, you did try. You watched Duck Soup.
I did.
Thinking maybe the Marx Brothers would then make your list, and we're including it as part of this marathon. But you didn't have the experience you were hoping for. But that's what these marathons for us are really all about, filling in the holes in our cinematic educations. With Animal Crackers, it's a film that really all takes place in one setting at a large estate where a woman named Mrs. Rittenhouse is holding a gala event for Captain Spaulding. That's Groucho Marx. He's an explorer. He's been off to Africa. At the same time, she's unveiling a famous painting. And really, that's all you need to know about the basic setup of this play. I'm curious, Josh, for you, coming off Duck Soup a year ago, did you have a better time with Animal Crackers? And specifically, were the performances and the gags we see here, there are a lot of famous ones that even I was aware of just from the legacy of Groucho Marx, having not seen any of their films. Was all of that for you enough to transcend the fact that this is basically just a film stage show or stage play?
I had a much better experience with Animal Crackers, and I don't want to spend a lot of time comparing it to Duck Soup because we are going to watch it again. So we'll get a chance to do that and hopefully dig a little deeper into my experience with that film. But yeah, this was a lot of fun. I don't know that I'd now put them in my top five comedy ensembles because it's a very particular style of humor that may not, we'll see, still just one film in, may not hit my sweet spot. But one of the things that Mike mentions, the anarchy, did resonate with me. I really appreciated that element and how thoroughly they come into this scenario and just blow everything up, this high society scenario, and anything that has any semblance of propriety, they're going to turn on its head. And it also reminded me how much I loved Bugs Bunny, a character that's clearly influenced by Groucho, how much I loved Bugs Bunny as a kid. That same sense of coming in and exposing not only hypocrisies, but just anyone who thinks there's something special, Bugs is going to take down. That's what Groucho is doing here. And so, yeah, this was a lot of fun. Comic masterpiece. Maybe not my comic masterpiece, okay, if that's fair.
Yeah, and I love that you make the Bugs Bunny comparison, because that's one I'm pretty sure I've been aware of. There always has been that connection, even down to the fact that Bugs Bunny often has a carrot in his mouth, like Groucho has his
trademark
cigar. Yeah,
and he's done impressions of Groucho in some shorts. So,
you're right,
yeah.
But for me, maybe this is to be expected, being the big Woody Allen fan that I am. The biggest thing I took away from this film, the biggest pleasure for me, was seeing how much Woody Allen was clearly influenced and inspired by Groucho Marx, especially his early comedies. Those quick one-liners, those sarcastic quips, where it's almost like he's in another film than the characters.
Mm-hmm.
And even though he's saying it not directly to the audience, he's saying it to the character, but it's almost as if he's having a private moment with us, and the other person doesn't even know how to react and is oblivious to it and just goes on with the scene. You get that a lot in early Woody Allen films, and I wasn't surprised. I went to verify this, that if you go to Manhattan, one of my all-time favorite Woody Allen films, one of the famous scenes in that movie is Woody's monologue about the things that are the most important in life. What do we live for? The first thing he says is Groucho Marx. So obviously Woody has a soft spot for Groucho, and that was a pleasure I took from this film. That may have been about the only pleasure I took from it, unfortunately. And I'm going to be the one now to get the hate mail for not having the proper experience that I should have had with Animal Crackers. But it really, Josh, didn't do anything for me. And I have a very specific reason why. And it's the reason why I'm also very hopeful for the rest of this marathon. Because I read somewhere that The Coconuts and Animal Crackers, their first two films, were the last films of theirs that were taken from a successful stage show.
Right.
And the other ones are films, and not just film stage plays. That was really my biggest issue. It's just so obviously a stage play that they literally just plopped the camera down and performed it as that. And you end up with these awkward entrances and exits and these dead spaces after jokes and gags where the laughter presumably would go if it was a stage play or a vaudeville show. And you've got Margaret Dumont giving, for me, just frankly, an awful screen performance. She plays Mrs. Rittenhouse. She's very prominent here in the movie, and she's like a comedian on a stage who wants to make sure that everybody in the audience, including the back row, can see all of her reactions. So every face that she makes is very big and grand, and she makes the same bemused look 1,000 times, sometimes 1,000 times within 1 3-minute scene. It's kind of like when you watch a really bad extra perform in a movie. They're in the background a little bit, but they're supposed to be reacting to what the main character is doing, and you see them constantly ooh and ah and overdo it. That's what I felt like watching Margaret Dumont here. And just in general, the stiffness of those confines of being so clearly a play prevented me from really fully embracing the anarchy that you found a connection to.
The structure didn't really bother me. I completely understand what you're talking about, but I sort of took that as a given. That didn't really bother me. But it's interesting that you bring up Dumont, because I think the problem there, and I agree, it doesn't really work, even though I know she's renowned as this Marx Brother collaborator. She's essentially supposed to be the straight man here. But I think what her performance reveals is the raging egomania that's at the heart of Groucho's comedy. Now, I'm not saying this is a bad thing, but it is a distinctive, and in the case of his interplay with Dumont, I think it has negative effects.
He's mean to her.
That gets into a little bit of duck soup. We may get to that,
okay,
because he's much kinder to her, from my memory, in Animal Crackers.
Wow.
But what is not happening is the interplay you usually get between a comic and their foil. There's no recognition. She's simply there so that he has someone to direct the lines at.
To rip off of.
There's no interplay. And this is just one example of how everything, you talked about him directing lines to the camera, which he does, because that's another way for him to acknowledge, yeah, this is all about me. I know you're in on it. I know I'm in a scene. Also notice how many of the set pieces involve Groucho in the center of a room with everyone at this party forming a semicircle around him as an audience. Now, I know part of that is a necessity. we're supposed to be noticing how aghast they are at his ridiculousness in this high society event. You could also communicate that through individual close-ups, right. But they don't choose to do that.
No.
They put Groucho in this auditorium-like setting so that he's performing. We're not enough audience for him. He needs two audiences.
That's all they're there for.
And I'm wondering if there's going to be some sort of limitation to that, because it worked for me in this film. He's very funny. But at the same time, there's also a wall that's put up there where you can only get so far with the comedy.
Show you a thing or three.
Oh, Captain.
Sending for the police. Take that to my lawyers. Sending for the police, eh? I say take that to my lawyers.
Well, I am taking it.
Honorable Charles H. Hungadunga. Care of Hungadunga, 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 and McCormick. Semicolon.
How do you spell semicolon?
All right, make it a comma. Honorable Charles H. Hungadunga, 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 McCormick. Gentlemen, question mark.
Do you want that in the letter?
No, put that in an envelope.
You're listening to Film Spotting. We're discussing the first film in our four-film Marx Brothers marathon. It's Animal Crackers from 1930. It's the first Marx Brothers film that I've seen. And as I said, seeing the Woody Allen connection was fun. Also, just finally becoming acquainted with Groucho Marx in the flesh, so to speak, was worth it.
Seen
to see
the reality.
This movie, because I only know him from Woody and from Bugs right. Bunny and from pop culture references. So that was a little bit of a thrill. And also, just watching all the different brothers, especially the big three, not so much Zeppo, though we see that a little bit, but the big three show off their talents. I had no idea how versatile they were as performers.
Musicians.
They weren't just comedians. They were musicians, and they are all supremely talented. So that was fun to watch as well. But this gets back to your point about how largely we're there to just behold Groucho, just as the cast is largely there to behold the genius of Groucho. The reason why there's no interplay between him and Margaret Dumont, really, is because there's no story here. There is a lot of plot. There's yes. enough plot yeah. in this film for 12 movies, but there really isn't any story. There isn't any coherent narrative tissue to really care about. And I know people listening are going to say, well, it's a Marx Brothers movie. What did you expect? Well, I don't know what I expected, but I was hoping for that humor and for their versatility and how they perform to be part of a story that I actually in some way cared about at all. Even with a dumb comedy, you still have to have a narrative that grabs you. And really, this whole film, as a stage play, is just a succession of gags.
Mm-hmm.
It's just one gag after another, largely inconsequential to a lot of the other plot elements at times. And yes, it was fun watching Harpo play the harp and watching Chico on the piano, but why? What really are they doing in the story? What are they serving? Not a whole lot. There's also this extended sequence with Arabella and Johnny, the two lovers who I'm not even sure why they're in this movie, and they have this long, drawn-out love scene where they sing about their love for each other, and it just did give me the sense of maybe on a vaudeville stage or something where you get the curtain close and a new number starts. That might work. But watching a film, I actually do want a story.
Let me throw this at you to see if I can bring you over to appreciating it a little bit more. Did you have any enjoyment with this concept of the painting? How there are, you mentioned a million plots going on, and among those plots are people trying to steal or replace this painting. There are two parties who are trying to do this at the same time,
right.
and they're trying to put up a forgery. It reminded me of Kiarostami's Certified Copy.
I thought about that a little bit. I did.
And
I tried to intellectualize it, Josh.
At first I thought, okay, put that away. Let Adam make that point. But at the very end, it comes back in a very pointed manner where it makes me think that they were spending a little time on this more than just making it part of the plot, because they look at this painting. All the people at the party are gathered around at the climactic moment, and they're
yeah.
trying to decide, where is the painting? What's happened to the
where's
painting?
Where's the original?
And three of them come out, and the joke is they can no longer tell which is the certified copy. And again, this is mostly lampooning that these high society folks act like they're big art connoisseurs and they can't really tell. But I think there were some interesting things going on there, too, about what is a real copy.
Yeah, I tried. I tried to go there.
It's not going
to
work.
Though maybe I could argue instead that it shows the validity of critics, because in that climactic scene, you've got the quote unquote expert,
mm-hmm.
the art expert slash critic who says, I know that this one is the real thing because look at the humanity and look at the depth and the artistry there, and everyone buys it.
Right.
So,
I thought that was kind of fun.
Well, Animal Crackers, I'd say, was kind of fun. Not enough fun for me, unfortunately, but
I definitely have hope for the rest of the marathon. I'm certainly not going to ride off the Marx Brothers just yet. We'll get to the second movie in our marathon next week. We're hoping to make this 4 weeks straight of Marx Brothers films. And as we sit here and record right now, we're not sure whether it will be Horse Feathers or Monkey Business. We left that up to our listeners. We still have that poll up right now on our marathons page at filmspotting.net. So if you want to know what film you should be watching to prepare for next week, just go to that marathons page and you'll see the winner of the poll. We're going to follow your direction. You can also see there the complete Marx Brothers lineup.
Up next, I'll be Friday to Adam's Robinson Crusoe as we name our favorite survival movies. The Film Spotting Top 5 is next. Stay with us.
Can I see what's going wrong with me? I used to have it all, now I'm alone. I never say I'm better off this way. I need something to do, somewhere to
thank you time here on the show, Josh, or as our listeners have dubbed this segment now, time to pay the dealer. We'll get to your donations in a moment, but we do want to share a plug for the Q&A with Jeff Goldsmith, as we usually do here in this part of the show. His great podcast that includes interviews with screenwriters, directors, and actors can be found in iTunes. Just do a search for the Q&A with Jeff Goldsmith. He also has his Backstory iPad app, which you can find via iTunes as well. We also want to share a quick note about our featured artist this week. It's a band called The Cloud Nothings. If you don't like The Cloud Nothings, they're a band out of Cleveland, Ohio. You can blame our producer, Sam Van Halgren.
Send complaints his way.
They're one of his picks, as most of our musical choices are here on the show. But we wouldn't play them if one of us didn't sign off on it. And I checked out the tracks we're featuring this week, and I'm a fan. So Cloud Nothings is our featured artist this week. Josh, we'd also be remiss if we didn't take a second to plug MoviePass. They're our partner. We've had them for a couple months here on the show. It's a great product, if product is the right word, a great service that they offer. I've got my MoviePass card, the app, on my iPhone, and I love being able to go to movies, check in there with my app, and use my card to see movies, not for free, but I am paying just a flat monthly subscription rate and get to see at least one movie a day. More than make your money back. It's been a great service for me so far. And if you want in on the action, all you have to do is go to moviepass.com/filmspotting and use the offer code filmspotting, and you get $10 off your first month of subscription. Again, that's moviepass.com/filmspotting, and just use the show name filmspotting as your code. Let's go ahead and then get to our donations and our thank yous this week, Josh. We start with two new $10 a month subscribers.
Jonathan in Minot?
Minot, North Dakota. It's not French.
Thanks for clarifying that. Thank you, Jonathan. That's in North Dakota. And also Old Johnny from Bergen, Norway.
Yeah, it's O-L-E. I don't think it's Ole for someone in Norway.
Ola. I should know this, being part Norwegian.
Yeah, come on, you're Norwegian. How did you
part,
just totally
only
butcher
part,
that?
And that part doesn't know how to pronounce Ola.
Apparently not. Some new $5 a month subscribers, Liston right here in Chicago, and Rob in Kings Park, New York.
I've been listening to the show for quite a while, but Adam, it was your praise for Greta Gerwig at the wrap party that finally pushed me to reach out to you guys and to reach into my pocket for a donation. I write for an online publication, The Inflatable Ferret, and in our 12 for 2012 year-end picks, we too recognized Gerwig's committed and hilariously eccentric performance in Damsels in Distress. Anyway, thanks for all of the education and entertainment. And Josh, I need to even out the praise, so I'll tell you that I wholly side with you on the debate over the titles Prometheus and Killing Them Softly.
You were doing so well, Rob. You were doing so well. You didn't really need to even out the praise there. We also heard from Elaine from Fayetteville, Georgia.
I stumbled upon Film Spotting in September of last year when I was searching for other podcasts to fill the hour commute to and from college every day. It was episode number 414, and I knew I had found something good when I became entirely absorbed in your conversation about contemporary Iranian films without having seen or even having heard of a single one. Fast forward to the present, where Film Spotting is something I can't live without. You guys, along with Film Spotting SVU, have come to the rescue in the most monotonous of situations, especially the 2.5 days straight I spent alphabetizing files at work this winter. Oh, that does sound rough. I would have gone insane if I hadn't had your back catalog to listen to. I'm only 19 and not a film buff at all, so I get legitimately excited whenever you guys mention a film I've actually seen. Even so, it is so entertaining to listen to you both talk about movies that it doesn't even matter that I haven't seen 99% of the films you mention. So all in all, you guys are wonderful, and thanks so much for all you've done. Little by little, because of Film Spotting, I'm becoming a cinephile.
Wow, what a nice note. In retrospect now, I'm a little bit embarrassed that we read all of Elaine's message on air just because she had so much praise.
I feel like
for
we're
us.
Patting ourselves in the back a little
maybe
bit.
Just a little too much, heaven forbid. Let's get to a new Buck a Show donor, and this should be a fun one, Josh. We're going to put your pronunciation skills to the test again. Take it away.
Guys, I started listening to your podcast in the summer of 2008 during my first deployment to Afghanistan. Before you start with the thank you for your service stuff, I'll tell you that I was there as a civilian. I never was deployed when I was in the Army. I was a bit skeptical when Josh took over for Maddie, but I've come to enjoy his viewpoints and his talents during Massacre Theater. Please share some with the SVU team. This is getting to be a problem here.
It is.
As they are also doing great work. I'll try to keep up with the Buck a Show thing in the future. Thanks. All right, I'm going to go with Jairo J. Benavides. He says, I won't help you with the pronunciation here. In case you read my name on the show, I will enjoy hearing your fumble through it.
I'm going to go out on a limb and say I think you came fairly close.
Yeah? All right.
That's how I would have said it anyway, but that really means nothing. But thank you for your extremely generous donation. We also got this donation from another very longtime listener, and she acknowledges that here, Serena Bramble. She's been listening since 2008 when she Googled Carol Lombard and stumbled upon our much-heated discussion over My Man Godfrey as part of our Screwball Comedy Marathon. Sam and I did disagree about that film. He loved My Man Godfrey. But Serena Bramble, I'll also note, one of my favorite all-time film spotting names.
Yes.
It's just fun to say. She says, now I feel I have enough of a minor post-Christmas financial windfall to donate. Sadly, not enough to cover a trip to Sundance, but at least cover movie tickets for one review. I'm currently in my final year at CSU Monterey Bay studying teledramatic arts and technology, and I'm a freelance film editor, including contributing video essays to the IndieWire blog Press Play. Thank you so much for your hard work and for constantly expanding my mind in the world of film. Here's to a great year at the cinemas in 2013. Also, looking ahead to your Max Ophuls marathon, I don't know how widely available The Reckless Moment is. To my mind, it's never been released on DVD. And if you cannot stream it, I have a recorded DVD-R copy I would be happy to lend you guys if it should come to that.
Ah, we have a connection.
We do, if we need it. And Ophuls is going to follow our Marx Brothers marathon. It's nice to see Serena, as I said, longtime listener, and she's getting some chances to do film criticism there, largely because of, if I have this right, Matt Zoller-Seitz, who's a critic I really, really respect. He has given Serena some opportunity, so that's great to see. Congratulations, Serena. A few more donations here before we go. Shohaku in Wilton, Connecticut, and Sam, with his Sam Van Halgren nickname, Savage Necktie. He's in Jackson Heights, New York.
In honor of the birth of my daughter, Karina, he says, I think I donated last in honor of my wedding. I hope more recently than 2010. So happy to hear the live wrap-up with nicknames again.
That was a fun segment with Sam to revisit those nicknames and get a few new ones in the mix as well. Sam is another longtime listener, and he donated $20.13 to the cause in honor of his daughter Karina being born. Congratulations, guys. Eric in Bratislava, Slovakia also donated this week.
Really appreciate your podcast. And Josh, keep it up. Casa de mi Padre was indeed great.
Oh, wait, before you get that smile on your face that you can't take off.
I did hear it was huge in Slovakia, though.
I'm sure it was. Peter in Chicago says, I'm an aspiring film critic here in Chicago with 2+ years of movie writing under my belt and was hoping I could toss out a plug for my film blog, wortsofwisdom.com. That's W-E-R-T-Z. I recently posted my comprehensive best of list for 2012 and would love to hear your people's thoughts on my picks. In fact, if you or Josh feel so inclined, you can tell me where I went wrong putting Django Unchained on my most overrated list. Now I want to take the plug back or give the wrong website. While I enjoyed the film, it feels less substantial than previous Tarantino work, too interested in the genre elements and the gore, and makes me anxious for the last segment of Quentin's career.
Well, genre elements and gore, that is
what Tarantino
does. Yeah. So yeah, I think he about nailed it with Django Unchained.
Exactly. He goes on to say, you guys have no idea how much your show helps me break down films that I otherwise would be left to parse on my own, and how important this is to a wannabe critic. While I don't always agree with you, Casa de mi Padre? Really, Josh? You have taught me one of the most valuable lessons a film lover can learn. More often than not, arguing about a film leads to a better understanding of it.
Clearly, Peter needs to spend more time in Slovakia.
He may need to. I'm stuck in here.
Hi, my name's Steve Coogan, and you're listening to Film Spotting.
The sea's only gifts are harsh blows. And occasionally the chance to feel strong. Now, I don't know much about the sea, but I do know that that's the way it is here. And I also know how important it is in life, not necessarily to be strong, but to feel strong. To measure yourself at least once. To find yourself at least once in the most ancient of human conditions. Facing the blind, deaf stone alone, with nothing to help you but your hands and your own head.
You're listening to Film Spotting. That's Emil Hirsch as Chris McCandless from the Sean Penn-directed Into the Wild, talking about facing the death stone alone with nothing to help you but your hands and your own head. I think that nicely sums up probably a fair number of our choices here as we get into the Film Spotting Top 5, our favorite survival movies. And maybe we can touch on Into the Wild a little bit as we shake out what we consider a survival movie, because as soon as you do a search for it online, you get such an array of different options. You get end-of-the-world films, post-apocalyptic end-of-the-world films, wilderness movies like Into the Wild, largely natural disasters like The Impossible, and that's what inspired our list this week, our discussion earlier in the show of the film The Impossible. There's shipwrecks, there's war movies, there's maniacal killer movies, so a lot of variations on the survival theme. Josh, how did you limit it, and how did you form your list?
I think we did disallow maniacal killers, right?
We
didn't want to go that way. We talked about it being survival of a specific event. Now, this didn't have to be a natural disaster. It could, but it didn't have to be. So I sort of kept those criteria in mind.
Okay. And I don't think I kept myself strictly limited to having to see an event unfold on screen, but it was a case where we didn't want all of those end of the world movies where it's now 100 years in the future and we're seeing how they're getting along, how they're surviving. That seems to be its own genre, just as serial killer movies or zombie movies, horror films, basically, where you've got some kind of creature or monster of some sort chasing down our protagonist. We didn't want to go that route with these survival movies. And Into the Wild, specifically, I know is a movie you love. So how did that not make your top five? Because I know it didn't.
It didn't. It could have, though. I think it counts. I think it fits our criteria. For me, the survival aspect of it comes in to the last section.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was more looking for films that really encompass it as a whole. That's
okay.
The only reason.
I think that's a very valid point. That's also why, for me, it got bumped just to honorable mentions. But I'm with you in appreciating that Sean Penn film. One note before we jump into our list, Grave of the Fireflies, maybe for me the most devastating survival film. It's in our pantheon, of course, so not eligible for this top five. What is your number five?
My number five is Rabbit Proof Fence, the 2002 film from Australian director Philip Noyce. It's based on a true story. I think probably a lot of survival films, for whatever reason we're going to find, are based on true stories. This one is about three biracial girls who were moved from their Aboriginal families in 1931 by the Australian government. This was part of some misguided program meant to civilize them. The girls escaped their captors and then walked more than 1,200 miles back to their home. And they mostly followed this endless fence that had been constructed to keep rabbits out of farmland. Now, because the girls have these natural survival skills, they're able to cover up their tracks. They can even elude the professional trackers who are sent after them. So it does become this tale of these unlikely kids trying to survive on their own. It was also something of a revival film for Noyce, I felt. He had kind of lost his way with Hollywood pictures like, there were action films like Clear and Present Danger and The Saint. That was the sort of stuff he had been making up until this point. And he scales back and takes an unobtrusive approach here, I felt. He doesn't amp things up like those action films did. I really like how he uses this central visual motif of the fence in an ironic way, because it's this thing that's been constructed to divide and keep apart, and it clearly for the girls becomes this unifying force.
Yeah, I like that movie as well. I remember feeling like it went over the top a little bit in vilifying the bad guys. He's a bad guy, but just in how it almost made Kenneth Branagh to be a horror movie villain in some ways. But hey, I don't like to walk from my car to the grocery store. So, you know, that's too far of a walk in the parking lot. So I remember just being astounded that this was a true story.
And it was criticized. It did receive a lot of criticism for that in terms of historical accuracy and how it portrayed that character.
Okay.
So yeah, I do.
I wasn't aware of that. My number five is a film from Ingmar Bergman. It's called Shame. and it's from 1968. It's a tough sit. And yes, there are a lot of Ingmar Bergman films that can be tough sits, but this is one of those that really is lacking in that humanistic touch that I do think you get, and even some hope a lot of times from Ingmar Bergman in his films. This is a very simple story about a husband and wife played by longtime collaborators of Bergman, Max von Sydow and Liv Ullmann, and there's a civil war going on, and they try to escape from it. They basically just flee society and say, we don't want to be part of this world, so we're going to go start our own life kind of far away in this rural area. I think it may even be an island of some kind, but for whatever reason, I haven't seen it for a little while, they do get brought back. They get brought back into society, and it just becomes a matter of then how they're going to avoid dying in these terrible war conditions. Pauline Kael, for whatever it's worth, loved this film. She called it a masterpiece. She said it is an account of what people do to survive. She equated it in some ways to Jean-Luc Godard's film Weekend. But I love how Bergman makes it this allegory of survival where you don't even know what war this is. It's a completely made-up war. It doesn't get into really who's fighting who or why. It doesn't matter. It's emblematic of society and strife in general. And what you see in this movie is something that's going to come up definitely as I get to another one of my films, but I think it happens in a lot of survival films, is as the conditions worsen, as the stress on the characters worsen, what you really see is a personality disintegration. You start to see them lose the traits that define who they are as people as they become more and more savage and more animalistic. And it just gets bleaker and bleaker until you basically see them as having no humanity left at all. So Shame from 1968 is my number five.
Yeah, you're right. That is a common thread. And it can go the other way, too, as they get distilled to their basic person. Sometimes that's a really good person that arises, and sometimes it's just an animal.
That's true. Sometimes people are tested and they actually rise to that challenge and the best comes out of them, but often that doesn't seem to be the case.
Well, my number four, I did consider for this slot The Black Stallion, but I recently included it in top five movie pets. So instead I went with another film from Black Stallion director Carol Ballard.
A horse can't be a pet, Josh. But I digress.
Come on. Black Stallion was a pet. 1983's Never Cry Wolf is where I'm going this time. I will confess, this is a nostalgia pick for me. I haven't seen it since, but I do remember it as a kid, and it fed this fascination I had for survival stories around that time. I think I probably would have been 9 or 10, something like that. Charles Martin Smith stars as a biologist who's sent to find out what's been decimating the caribou population in the Canadian wilderness. Wolves are the suspects, but in his studies, the biologist begins to form a bond with these two wolves in particular, and he even starts mimicking their behavior in order to survive himself, because he's completely out of his element on this expedition.
What had taken me 6 hours and 27 cups of tea, he accomplished in just a few minutes. At each of the places that I'd marked, he made his mark on the opposite side, indicating that my boundary was acceptable to him. And thus he granted me the space for Lupus Base 1.
I was a big nature buff as a kid, and this really did hit a sweet spot because it gave me that science-backed aspect of the story, which I was interested in. But there are all these other weird elements going on in this story. You have a little bit of horror. You think of the Wolfman coming into this. There's the fairy tale element, the big bad wolf, of course. And even animism comes into play. I didn't know exactly what to make of all of this at the time, but it did mesmerize me.
So again, what year was this that you saw it?
1983, it would have been.
Okay, so you were fairly young then. You saw it as a kid, basically.
Yeah, I think, well, let me do the math. So I would have been 9.
Yeah. It's one I missed when I was a kid.
Really?
I haven't
caught
up with since, so you've got me intrigued. My number four is a more recent film and one I definitely know you've seen and appreciate. It's the Kelly Reichardt film Meek's Cutoff, and I think you could probably argue that there's a decent chunk of the movie where they're not in clear danger, but it's always lingering.
Yeah.
It's always getting closer and closer as their supplies dwindle, as they start to realize that they're more and more hopelessly lost, and they may never find water. They're running out of food. As that journey becomes more and more futile, and they don't trust Stephen Meek of the title, their guide, that he's really going to get them to where they're trying to go, and they're not getting any closer to civilization. That's where that real doubt comes in, and they realize that they're in dire straits. It's set back in 1845, this small group of people trying to move out west, ostensibly in search of a better life, clearly not finding it. A big reason why, as I looked at my notes from when we reviewed this film, that I really responded to it was, I love how Reichert and the screenwriter just get us right into the story. It's slowly paced. It's deliberately paced, but I think effectively so. We don't need to know who all these characters are. We don't need to know why they're on. We just need to get into the journey, and we can figure a lot of that out for ourselves, and we can start to see those interpersonal dynamics at work. And there's a sense, as I suggested even early on, where they're hoping that they're going the right way. There's a sense that they may be lost right from the get-go, and that's what really raises the stakes of this film. It's especially heightened when you consider that the most interesting characters in the movie, at least our window to this all, is largely Michelle Williams. And because she's a woman, she's in the back the whole time. So as the men start to distrust and the women start to distrust where Meek is taking them, the women are in an even worse position than their men because they can't really weigh in. Just because of the nature of the times, they have to be in the back. And Reichert sits back there with the camera and forces us to be back there with the women and just overhear what they're saying and wonder how this is all going to come out. I'm a big, big fan of Meek's Cutoff.
Well, we talked at the start, or you referenced war films being a potential category for a list of survival pictures. And at first, when you said that, I thought, well, that doesn't really make sense. But I started spinning some titles through my mind. And the first one where it did fit was The Big Red One. This is Samuel Fuller's 1980 epic. It was sort of a career capstone for him.
It's a good movie.
And it was based on his own experiences in World War II. It follows a band of soldiers. They're led by Lee Marvin Sargent. Follows them from the shores of North Africa to the beaches at Normandy, all the way to the Falkenau death camp in Czechoslovakia. And as it proceeds, it certainly felt to me less like a march of triumph or even something that had strategic purpose. It was more desperate wanderings is what this band was doing. And it made me realize how often in warfare that probably the first mission is simply survival. That's what you're primarily concerned with. I didn't catch up with this film until 2004. At the time, a restored print played at the Cannes Film Festival. So it then came over and played in some American theaters. And the original was heavily cut upon its release. So if you haven't seen this picture and you want to check it out, be sure to find that restored print.
Yeah, that is a very good film. Incidentally, Desperate Wanderings, the alternate title for Meek's Cutoff. It very well could have been. You're listening to Film Spotting. We're sharing our top five survival movies. It's a tie-in with our discussion this week of the new film, The Impossible. We've talked a little bit about the worst in humanity coming out during these survival experiences. That definitely applies to my number three, even though it's a little bit of an odd choice because the person struggling to survive is not our protagonist, and in fact doesn't even get a lot of screen time, but that's really the whole point of the story. It's the Billy Wilder film Ace in the Hole that focuses on Kirk Douglas as Chuck Tatum. He's a very ambitious, cutthroat journalist who has been fired from all the New York papers and is trying to revitalize his career in Albuquerque, New Mexico, and he comes across the story potentially of a lifetime where this innocent, naive man named Leo Minosa gets caught. He's looking for, I believe, Indian artifacts, and he gets stuck in a cave. And as the rescuers come and try to get him out, Chuck Tatum realizes that if he gets them to drill a little bit differently and work a little bit more slowly, he can spin this into a yarn that not only the Albuquerque newspaper and other newspapers will pick up, but this could become a national story and he can relaunch his career.
Then it does bother you a little.
Not enough to stop me. I'm on my way, and if it takes a deal with the crooked sheriff, that's all right with me. And if I have to fancy it up with an Indian curse and a broken-hearted wife for Leo, that's all right, too.
Not with me, it isn't. And not with a lot of others in this business. Phony, below-the-belt journalism, that's what it is.
Not below the belt, right in the gut, Mr. Boot. Human interest.
You heard me, phony. For all I know, there isn't even a Leo down there.
Yes, there is. Tatum made sure of that. Look, I've waited a long time for my turn at bat. Now that they've pitched me a fat one, I'm going to smack it right out of the ballpark.
I love, love, love Kirk Douglas in this film. I think this is a very underappreciated Billy Wilder film. It certainly was at the time it came out. It was his first film not working with Charles Brackett, his longtime collaborator. It was his first true flop with audiences, and critics didn't like it either. But fortunately, as more critics and more film buffs have seen it recently, it has earned a better reputation. And you're just aware the whole time as everything is swirling around that really Chuck Tatum has orchestrated. And the film was originally called The Big Carnival. It was the studio that changed it on Wilder, but it becomes this circus-like atmosphere outside this cave. You're so aware, whether you see him or not, of what that guy, Leo, is going through and how he's being exploited by trying to survive, being stuck in there without food, without water. They really can't get to him. And so for me, it was one that definitely came to mind when we were talking about survival films. I thought about poor Leo in that cave.
That is a great pick. It didn't occur to me at all, but it certainly fits. I'm going to go somewhere very obvious for number two. So obvious, I kind of wanted to leave it off this list, but it's a film I really do like, so I had to keep it on. Castaway, Robert Zemeckis' first survival film. I think you could argue Flight is a survival film in a couple of different ways, but this was his 2000 drama with Tom Hanks as Chuck Nolan, the plane-wrecked FedEx supervisor. You just have to admire the bravery of the movie's middle section on the island, in which Hanks holds the screen on his own. There's very little emotion cueing music going on here, or voiceovers, or any other crutches that you might expect to sustain all of this. And the loss of civilization is really palpable in some wonderful touches that Zemeckis gives us. If you remember all those FedEx packages washing ashore, they're just sort of taunting reminders of what Chuck's previous package life was like. I do think the true beauty of Castaway ultimately is also how it becomes a survival movie for everyone, not just those who are stuck on islands. There's the bookends to the film, which are really important. And we see things like cancer or job loss, stuff like that comes out of nowhere and it can strike with the violence of a plane crash. The movie makes room for that sort of reality as well. Plus, Castaway gives us Wilson, the volleyball, which is perhaps the best performance of all time by an inanimate object. I love Wilson.
I actually, going back to how I said that the Black Stallion couldn't be a pet, I think during that top five...
Didn't you propose Wilson? Did you have Wilson?
No, a listener did. A listener suggested that Wilson was the all-time great screen pet.
So I agree with that, too.
I'm not going with a volleyball either, unfortunately. But I do like Castaway. I remember I've only seen it once. I saw it in the theater. Didn't spend a whole lot of time dwelling on it, but it was a film I remember feeling kind of like a movie I really consider for this list as well, 127 Hours, the Danny Boyle film. Definitely a film about survival, and you think, okay, 90% of this film is going to take place with this main character stuck in one spot.
Right.
And we're going to be stuck there with him. How is this going to work? Well, Danny Boyle found a way to make it work, and so did James Franco. Similar with Castaway, though maybe less of it overall takes place on that island. How are they going to make it compelling to have a character just stuck there with nobody to talk to but a volleyball for that much screen time? They pulled it off, and it helps that you have Tom Hanks there as well. For my number two, really because any good top five list needs a movie with a disembodied hand scurrying around the floor and a bear, just for good measure, a bear running around this mansion, I've got to go with the Luis Buñuel film, The Exterminating Angel, for my number two survival movie. I'm going to say that as we're getting now to our top picks, this is probably the only one on either of our lists where the audience probably isn't actually rooting for the protagonists to survive. We'd actually kind of like to see them all go down here in this experience. And what the experience is, it's such a great setup, a great satirical setup. 20 or so people, rich, bourgeois, get invited to this home for this lovely dinner after the opera, and they find that they can't leave. They are physically unable to walk past the hallway there, really into the doorway area, and leave. And I say physically, even though it's really psychological. There's nothing in their way. There's no force field. There's no physical object standing in front of them, but they cannot bring themselves to leave. And a night turns into days, turns into weeks, and maybe even, I think they suggest at one point, it could be a month or so that they're stuck in this house. And what you get from Buñuel is you see how he is satirizing the manners, the society of manners, and the genteel behavior, and how that all collapses under these circumstances. Once they get stuck in a room together for an extended period of time, their true selves really come out and they turn on each other. And they even talk about, in a Lord of the Flies kind of way, how to maintain order. And they try to set up some rules, and they're almost forced to start a new society in this situation. I love about Buñuel, too, that you get moments like that. You get setups like that where it's completely unexplainable, and he doesn't ever try to explain it. Just like one of his films that made another top five of mine fairly recently, That Obscure Object of Desire, where he's got a female character, a major character in the movie, played by two different actresses, and they don't look anything alike. So it's really hard to fathom, but it works for that movie just as the setup here works for The Exterminating Angel. He really is dealing with hypocrisy of the ruling class, particularly in his native Spain under Franco, where they want to separate themselves from everyone else. They think they're better. So he basically says, okay, you get your wish. You get to be separated in this space, and let's see what really happens once they're there. It's a very fun, sometimes disturbing, totally wacky film, but a good one.
You really stretch the definition with this list. I like it.
I think
I like the approach.
When you watch them taking down tables and chairs and building
works.
A fire.
It
and
works.
Breaking water pipes yep. to drink water. It's a survival film, Josh.
I like it. Well, my number one is actually a film you already mentioned, Meek's Cut Off, which I just adore as well. It's one of my favorite films from 2011. And the only thing I'll add is that in capturing the sparseness of this experience that the pioneers are having mm-hmm. and getting lost, Reichert doesn't have to go dull. She's still audaciously artful, but within the historical setting so that it all works together. I think about all the lighting with the lanterns that's used so that it feels natural. That's the sort of lighting that would be there, but it also makes for these gorgeously muted compositions. And the whole movie is sparse. There's not a lot of talk or action or plot, as you mentioned, yet it does manage to evoke so much about survival, yes, but things like gender, civilization, which you touched on. It's a really rich film. And we get a lot of this in just glimpses. Poetic imagery is where a lot of it bubbles up. I always remember the shot of the canary. It's very early on in a cage being carried across mm-hmm. this river that they're trying to cross. And of course, it's a stand-in for the precarious state of the pioneers, too. But early on, we see that they're not in any sort of safe zone here.
No.
And it's likely going to get worse. I also think Meek's Cut Off has a great non-ending ending, which frustrated a lot of people.
Mm-hmm.
But for a survival movie, it was perfect.
Yeah, I think it was. And I think that there is something set up earlier in the film that justifies that end. And I love that you bring up the canary, because that's a case where it's such a great metaphor, because you see how in this vast open space, this bird that should be flying is nevertheless
right.
trapped. And
right.
it does speak to their situation. They are in this open territory, and yet they're very much confined by their circumstances. So, yeah, clearly we're both big fans of Meek's Cut Off.
Men are often haunted by things that happen to them in life, especially in war or other periods of great intensity. Sometimes you see these men walking the streets or driving in a car. Their lives seem to be normal, but they are not.
My number one survival movie, Josh, hear me out. I've got a tie. But it's a tie that's so good, even you can't argue with it. You love to berate me when I come up with ties, but you're gonna be on board with this one completely, because I don't see how anybody can separate these two films. They are the documentary from Werner Herzog, Little Dieter Needs to Fly, and the fiction, the narrative, I should say, counterpart, Rescue Dom.
Yeah. Go on, I'll think about it.
A few years ago. This is the documentary, I'll start with Little Dieter, that's about Dieter Dangler. He was a German-American Navy pilot who was on a naval carrier in the Vietnam War in the mid to late 60s, was flying on a mission, got shot down, and was taken prisoner in Laos. And what I love about this documentary, and I do like the documentary better than the film Rescue Dawn, and I could have just gone with that as my number one, but I think both films need to be seen, and I think they're obvious companions. But what I do love about Little Dieter is how I think it's in some ways a very good starting point for Werner Herzog. If you're not very familiar with his work and you want to see a film that's very Herzogian, but also just a great story, it's Little Dieter, because it's told largely in a very direct way, but it is full of these Herzog touches. You get these elements of the ecstatic truth that he talks about, where he'll recreate scenes. He even takes Dieter back to the exact spots in Laos and hires people to basically act as the guards, and they recreate some of these scenes to show us how he was tortured, how he had to move through the jungle. It's really fascinating stuff. And watching a character revisit mentally, psychologically, emotionally, those very harrowing circumstances is something that is really interesting to watch on screen. And Dieter in general is just such a fascinating, heroic character in a lot of ways. And what you get in the film as well, as I talk about some of those Herzogian touches, is you'll get moments where you realize that he staged certain sequences. There's one very early in the film, right at the beginning, where he tries to emphasize for us, the viewer, how Dieter Dangler now in his life appreciates the freedom he has of being able to open and close a door after being stuck in a prison for so long.
You see, this really seems strange to most people, but to me it's very important. It denotes freedom to be able to open or close a door. When I was a prisoner, that I couldn't open the door, and later on when I was dying, those big doors in the sky would open up. And so most people don't realize how important it is and the privilege that we have to be able to open or close a door. So anyway, that's how I got into, and so be it.
that was staged for the screen. And a lot of conventional documentarians don't like it when filmmakers take liberties like that. But I think it's fascinating. So again, Little Dieter is the favored film here, but I'll throw in Rescue Dawn as well, which does dramatize this with Christian Bale playing Dieter and his friend Dwayne Martin is played by Steve Zahn. And this is where, when it came out, Josh, I wondered, why do we really need this counterpart when we've got this documentary that's so good on its own? And one of the ways I think the film Rescue Dawn justifies itself is it's one thing to listen to Dieter Dangler talk about the friendship he had with Dwayne, but then to see it on screen in the form of this relationship with Steve Zahn's character is something completely different. It gives the viewer a different sense of it. And I do think that's worth it, or I do think that largely justifies the narrative film as well. In the grand scheme of Herzog, too, I love the fact that Dieter is this guy he's clearly fascinated by because he beat nature. You know, that's right, that's Herzog's right. Real antagonist in all of this always. And in the end, Dieter's a guy who managed to not only escape the prison, but he's a guy who escaped the jungle, which not many characters in Herzog films do. So that's my double feature, number one.
I realize I have no authority in these matters, but I'm not allowing it. I will only recognize Little Dieter Needs
Fair
to
enough.
Fly.
I'll take that. What about any other honorable mentions?
I thought about the Blair Witch Project, but I didn't know how that would go with our horror.
Yeah, it's definitely a horror film.
It is a horror film, but it's a lot about survival. And Lifeboat, I was hoping possibly it would make your list because it's a Hitchcock that's unseen by me, but came to mind immediately with this category.
Yeah, I tried to get it finished in time for this list. I had never seen it.
Okay.
I got about halfway through it and just couldn't finish it. So
okay.
Lifeboat is left off. I'm sure we're going to hear about that.
I also thought about The Road, that haunting adaptation of the Cormac McCarthy novel, Apollo 13, but I already had a Tom Hanks survival movie on my list, and then Open Water, the scuba divers versus sharks indie. It's really a strong minimalist exercise in nature horror.
I still can't bring myself to watch Open Water.
It's rough.
Just the concept is so horrifying to me. I imagine myself in that situation. I can't bring myself to watch it. We've already mentioned a couple of my honorable mentions, 127 Hours and Into the Wild. But also The Gray from this past year, the Liam Neeson film. The Road is one I considered as well, the Cormac McCarthy adaptation. And I think you could throw in Hunger, the Steve McQueen movie with Michael Fassbender, where he is a prisoner, an IRA prisoner, and he goes on a hunger strike because he's not being recognized as a political prisoner. And we really see his character go through a lot of suffering as he doesn't so much try to survive as just accept the inevitable of his situation. I'd also throw in the Mel Gibson movie Apocalypto. I like that film a lot. I kind of left it off because it's not a serial killer movie or a horror film by any means, but it is a movie where you've got kind of a bad guy or bad guys chasing down another person trying to kill him. So I left it off.
I do like Apocalypto, though.
Film.
I love the ending of
really,
the film.
Really, really well-made movie. Those are our top five survival films. Send us your picks or any other comments about the show to feedback at filmspotting.net.
You can also leave us a voicemail, 206-203-2463, or find us on Twitter at filmspotting and at facebook.com/filmspotting.
Out in wide release this weekend, Bullet to the Head, the new Sylvester Stallone action thriller, and the new drama Warm Bodies. This stars Nicholas Hoult, who we probably all discovered in the film About a Boy, but was also in the Colin Firth movie, A Single Man, Annalee Tipton from Damsels in Distress in Warm Bodies as well. It's directed by Jonathan Levine or Jonathan Levine. I'm not completely sure. And I had to look this up because I knew the name was familiar, Josh, but I couldn't remember what he'd made. And talk about a tale of two films for me.
Yeah.
His debut film was
the
a movie
whackness.
I just loathed.
Oh,
the
me
whackness.
Too.
Oh, thank you. You're
me
on
too.
My side. I saw it at Sundance. Just couldn't stand it. But then in 2011, he made 50-50 with Joseph Gordon-Levitt and Seth Rogen. And I think that's a really good film.
I'm with you. He's a very confusing director for
there
me.
There you go. So maybe Warm Bodies will be just right in the middle somewhere. Hopefully it's better than that. Opening in Chicago and other select cities around the country, 56 Up, the famed documentary series that I've never seen any of them.
Yeah, I was going
to
say, should we
so
just
bad.
Confess that we thought
to.
About reviewing this and then we realized how much work it would involve in catching
Let's
up
see,
with everything.
Let me do the math here. 7 movies we'd have to catch up with.
We chose to remain ignorant.
Yeah, sorry, not going to happen. The documentary Beware of Mr. Baker. I'm a big Ginger Baker fan. He was the drummer for Cream. Loved his stuff there. Also, a jazz drummer has made some great stuff over the years. That's a documentary I want to see. Neighboring Sounds, a film I know a lot of really hardened cinephiles, Josh, love this movie from last year. It's a documentary, I believe, set in Brazil. And Stand Up Guys, this is a new film starring Alan Arkin Al Pacino and Christopher Walken. That's opening in limited release as well. Next week on the show, we are going to talk about A Glimpse Inside the Mind of Charles Swan, the new film from Roman Coppola. Bill Murray stars in that. We did consider doing our top five Bill Murray scenes, but instead, thinking about Roman Coppola and his first film since CQ, we're going to share our top five director comeback movies. If you have any thoughts, got any picks you don't want us to omit, send them to us, feedback@filmspotting.net. We also will get to the second film in our Marx Brothers marathon.
Film Spotting is produced by Golden Joe Dassault and Sam Van Halgren. Without Sam and Golden Joe, this show wouldn't go. Thanks to associate producer Candace Griffiths, and special thanks to Tori Malatia and Shauna Coyne at WBEZ. Our featured music this week, Cloud Nothings. Learn more at cloudnothings.com. For Film Spotting, I'm Josh Larson.
And I'm Adam Kempinar. Thanks for listening.
This conversation can serve no purpose anymore. Goodbye.